On the program today, the art of the tariff loophole, the business of climate change risk, and the making of a vegetable. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Wednesday, June 26th. Good to have you with us. We begin today where we often have lately, the trade war, the escalating tariffs between the U.S. and China. Perhaps you've heard that mentioned here before. Now, yes, for sure, those tariffs have had an impact on trade between the two nations. And during the G20 summit that starts on Friday in Japan, President Trump and President Xi Jinping will meet to talk about their relationship issues. But meanwhile, business finds a way to go on as usual. And many businesses have resorted to workarounds, loopholes, shall we say, that help them avoid paying these tariffs. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
Workarounds on tariffs, sometimes called transshipment, have been around as long as tariffs have existed, says Emily Blanchard, professor at Dartmouth. But right now, they're having a moment.
When tariffs were lower before this trade war, it wasn't a profitable strategy. Now that tariffs are going up, we would definitely expect to see transshipment becoming more popular.
And not all transshipments are created equal. Practices like shipping furniture made in China to a third country with lower tariffs like Vietnam and then removing the Made in China sticker, that's illegal. But doing most of the production in China and then the finishing touches elsewhere, that's arguably legal, says Michael Moore, who teaches economics and international affairs at George Washington University.
If you bring the product in and you use a screwdriver to screw in the last screw, that doesn't mean it's made in Vietnam. It has to be a substantive change in the product.
Like assembly, a new kind of paint, or a crucial part. Since the beginning of the trade war, a lot of goods made in China have been shipped from, say, Vietnam or other Southeast Asian countries, entering the U.S. via transshipments. Mary Lovely, an economist and fellow at the Peterson Institute, says industries like footwear, toys, and steel can use transshipment, but others can't, like
industries that have to be certified, so-called life and death industries. Artificial knees, any kind of medical products that are made in China, that whole supply chain is certified by U.S. regulators. You can't all of a sudden just say, oh, I happen to get a knee from someplace else.
That leaves those industries with no option but to pay those tariffs or move their production elsewhere altogether. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Hundreds of employees of online furniture seller Wayfair staged a walkout at the company's headquarters in Boston today. They were protesting the company's sale of $200,000 worth of mattresses to a detention camp for migrant children along the U.S.-Mexico border. Employees wanted the contract canceled. Wayfair says it won't do that. And Wayfair isn't the only company finding that doing business with firms that detain migrants for the U.S. government is tricky ethical territory. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports from KUT in Austin.
In recent weeks, reports have emerged that several border detention facilities are dangerously crowded, with children living in unclean and unsafe conditions. Now, protesting Wayfair employees say they don't want the company to enable, support, or profit from the practice of detaining people. But in a memo, the company told employees, quote, "We believe it is our business to sell to any customer who is acting within the laws of the countries within which we operate," unquote.
I think the company's response that says, all I have to do is follow the law and deal with customers who aren't breaking the law is not quite right.
Sandy Ryder is a business ethics professor at Washington and Lee University.
Whether we like it or not, businesses, companies are a part of our moral community. They affect the lives of individuals.
But how a company's decisions affect lives can cut both ways, says Linda Trevino. She teaches business ethics at Penn State.
You know, many people would say, look, you know, there are people sleeping on concrete floors. It would really be good if they had beds.
Then again, Trevino says the company isn't giving the beds away. Other companies have been caught in similar immigration quandaries as well. Just today, Bank of America said it would stop lending to companies that run detention centers. JPMorgan Chase made the same call a few months ago. Our Edward Freeman at the University of Virginia says there's one clear-cut issue for businesses navigating this space.
Should CEOs listen to their employees?
That's a question Google and Microsoft are dealing with. In the past year, employees at those and other companies have also pressured their bosses over government contracts they think are unethical. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wayfair, by the way, announced today it's donated $100,000 to the Red Cross. The walkout employees were not totally impressed. On Wall Street, traders also not entirely sure how to proceed in these topsy-turvy times. Markets were mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The world of venture capital is pretty mysterious, especially if you're an entrepreneur trying to make your startup dream a reality. The center of the VC world is one street in Menlo Park, California, in the heart of Silicon Valley. It's called Sand Hill Road. And now a big critique of venture capital is that it is so concentrated on this one road and a tiny group of investors, more than 80% of whom are men, mostly American, lots from Stanford, and they have historically picked startup founders who are a lot like them. Scott Cooper is managing partner of one of the most famous venture firms, Andreessen Horowitz. He's got a new book out called Secrets of Sand Hill Road, Venture Capital and How to Get It. Scott, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Your book is really a guide for the current world of venture capital, yeah. You know, as it works now. There have been a lot of critiques of that world, whether it's diversity or, you know, building insular cultures, funding the same people over and over. Do you also feel a responsibility to change the way this current world operates?
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right, which is the industry has not been done a great job on inclusion generally. And that's true both with female entrepreneurs as well as with, you know, entrepreneurs of color. Ultimately, I think the best thing we can do is try to address what we would call a network connectivity problem, which is we know there are great and smart entrepreneurs everywhere. And the question is, how do we reach out to those communities and make them feel like there is actually a home for them here? One of the things I do hope that we get out of the book is if we can demystify the business and make it feel accessible to people who are not in New York and Boston and California, I think that actually might have a positive impact from overall diversity and inclusion in the industry.
What is the next step? Like, you're clear in the book that you're not handing out Mark Andreessen's phone number. I get it. But, you know, let's say I am an entrepreneur in Iowa and I have a great idea and I read this book and I want money. Like, how do they get in? How do they translate that into action?
Yeah. So I think one of the most important things to do is to prove your mettle as an entrepreneur in some respects by showing your creativity and your willingness to kind of walk through walls and find a way to get an introduction into a firm. So we get a number of people, of course, who will send cold emails in and we look at those, but it's very hard to obviously kind of get those into the right hands. 95% of what we do comes from some referral source that at least we've known of or seen at some period of time. We like to see an entrepreneur find, you know, how many degrees of freedom do they need before they can find someone who actually knows us and can get something into our hands. And that's the same skill they're going to have to do when they're recruiting employees. It's the same skill they're going to need when they're trying to identify customer opportunities. And so that's our best advice, is kind of be persistent in trying to find a way in the door.
That sounds a little passive, I have to be honest. Like, we'll just wait here for these awesome people to find us and then we'll know how great they are. Like, do you also, or should you also, have the equivalent of sort of a publishing house slush fund, like a scouting?
So you're absolutely right, which is the way our business works is some of the stuff is we're lucky enough to have relationships who say, hey, I met this great person the other day. But the vast majority of our activities, you can think about them as outbound activities where we might have a thesis on an industry. And so as part of that, we're doing research and trying to identify the 5 or 10 companies who are doing something interesting in that space. That really is, quite frankly, you know, kind of a huge part of what the job is of being a general partner at a firm like this.
I will say it wasn't until last June, I think, right, that Andreessen hired its first female general partner. How important is that?
It's very important. And you're right. It did take us a while to do that. We've since hired 3 general partners. And one of the things that we recognized was as we were recruiting for GPs, we had a hard requirement, which is you had to have been a founder or CEO in order to be a general partner candidate. And not surprisingly, over time, we recognized, of course, that really narrowed the funnel of diverse candidates, just given the fact that the industry itself of founders and CEOs is not very inclusive. And so we felt like it was better for us to say, hey, if we relax that constraint and really focused on what is the unique quality that makes you attractive to entrepreneurs in your field, those types of things ought to count just as well and be just as important as whether you're a founder or CEO. So that's really helped us make progress, I think, on the inclusion side.
Scott Cooper is managing partner of Andreessen Horowitz and author of the new book, Secrets of Sand Hill Road, Venture Capital and How to Get It. Thanks for talking with me, Scott.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
From West Virginia to California, thousands of teachers have demanded better pay and even gone on strike for it. And a fair number of them got those increases, which brings us to our series, My Economy, people sharing what's happening in their personal economies. This one comes from a teacher at a school where teachers recently negotiated a pay raise. Here she is.
My name is Christy Williamson. I am a teacher and cheer coach at Ogden High School in Ogden, Utah. The population at Ogden High School is very diverse. We have kids that come from inner city Ogden, a lot of newcomers from different countries. And then I have a lot of wealthier parents who are doctors here, and they're all blended in here, and it makes for, I think, fun and interesting teaching. When I started the team, there was kids who weren't getting good grades. They were kind of being troublemakers in class. I had to set my standards pretty high, and I had to stick with those. I try really hard to like build relationships with those kids and just try to get down to like, why are you doing this? Like, what is your plan? What are you going to do after school? Either way, if you want to have a job and keep a job, you have to learn how to be on time. You have to learn to commit to something or be there when you say you're going to be there. I at the end of this year, I literally had a student who I walked him to class every single class period. Nothing that we did or said to him, like nothing was motivating him. And I made a deal with him. If you go, then I won't walk with you. But as soon as you stop, I'm going to be your walking buddy. He hated it because the kids were like, oh man, Coach Christie's walking him to class. Rough life, you know. But he went to class and the teachers are like, yeah, he's great once he's here, but he was never here before. So it is like, it is a constant struggle getting them to understand that. But to me, those things make teaching worth it. I'm doing myself a big favor and I'm taking off the month of July. You know, I'm just gonna hang out with my toddler who I feel like I never see, go to the pool, just kind of relax and decompress so that I don't burn myself out. And a lot of this, like, the teachers here are extremely selfless. They don't do it because like it's a paying job where you get the summers off. You know, we do it because like we love it and we want to make a difference.
Christy Williamson, who sounds like an absolutely wonderful teacher at Ogden High School in Ogden, Utah. This series only works with your help. So tell us your story at marketplace.org. Coming up.
We like to make an honest living, and we don't like that in the backyard.
Rolling the dice on where to put a casino. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 11 points, basically flat, to close at 26,536. The NASDAQ found 25 points, 0.3% to finish at 7,909. And the S&P 500 declined 3 points, 0.1% to end at 2,913. The Financial Times reported that Nike has stopped selling a line of shoes in China after the Japanese designer of those shoes expressed support for recent protests in Hong Kong in an Instagram post. A proposed law in Hong Kong to allow extradition to mainland China triggered those protests. Nike lost less than 0.1%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.05%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And as we approach the end of Marketplace's budget year, we're doing some numbers of our own. Part of being a responsible news organization, especially one that covers business and the economy, is fiscal responsibility. And we've got a target we need to hit by June 30th. We are closing in on our goal of 2,500 Marketplace investors for this drive, but we still do need to hear from you. Even a gift of just $5 will make a difference, so please donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The Trump administration recently took steps to limit climate science research within government agencies. It'll reduce the time frame covered by U.S. climate models and maybe stop including some kinds of projections, like worst-case scenarios. And this is happening at a time when private industry is trying to increase climate intelligence. Emily Mazzacarati is founder and CEO of the climate data firm 427, which works with companies to integrate what's happening with climate science into better business decisions. I recently visited her offices in Berkeley, California. Can you go ahead and just pronounce your last name for me? Because I don't want to...
Yes, Mazzacarati.
Mazzacarati.
Yeah.
Cool. And since I didn't see any giant projections or maps or quantum computers processing a bunch of big climate data in the office, I started by asking Mazzacarati, how does she figure any of this stuff out?
There are over 40 climate models globally that project what's going to happen to the planet in terms of temperature, precipitation, sea level rise. Those models are not for the faint of heart. So we have developed a set of tools and applications that extract and process the data and apply it to real economic assets. So real estate properties, corporate facilities, and help investors and corporations quickly see where there might be exposure and start thinking about what they can do to build resilience.
Mm-hmm. What do the companies do after you've advised them? I mean, I imagine the simplest answer is don't buy there or don't build there.
It depends.
But, right, if they already have or they've already built.
There's a range of things that they can do that includes sort of hardening from an engineering standpoint their facility. It can be working with insurance to make sure that they're well covered in case of certain events. And adaptation, as we described it, that will protect not just this company's facilities versus another, but the entire community, including the workers that live nearby and the roads that bring goods and services, right? So whether it's well-understood self-interest or broader community interest, everybody's better off if we're all protected.
So to what extent do you see this as part of this kind of evolving conversation around adaptation? Like the awareness that it's here, like you said, and that we will have to work
with that. It's really core. And for many years, we described ourselves as a climate adaptation firm as well. The first thing for adaptation is to understand your risk, right? And so that's really this foundational data layer that we provide. The only difference is the private sector calls it resilience and the governments call it adaptation, but it's really all moving in the same direction of preparing for those impacts.
Do you feel like then the work that you do, because there is this argument that, well, the businesses that can afford your services are going to do fine and everybody else is going to be left to the high water. That got dark in a hurry. But it sounds like you're saying you see a broader benefit in working with these businesses and helping them adapt and stay where they are?
Absolutely. We do work with the very large corporations, and they have the power and the wherewithal to be huge influencers in their communities, in their supply chains. We're also seeing some of our clients understanding that small businesses are actually going to be much more vulnerable. And so there's a role of local governments and financial institutions to help channel this information through smaller businesses.
Are any companies coming to you sort of after the fact? You know, like, does Facebook know that they are going to be underwater in 20 years?
I believe they know that, yes. And we see some of everything. We see a lot of companies coming right now because their investors are asking questions. And we see companies coming, not so much here, but in Europe, in Asia, there's a lot of regulatory pressure. And so both investors and corporations fully expect that they're going to be under regulation in a matter of 12 months, pretty much.
Turning your attention somewhat to resilience and adaptation, does it feel a little more hopeful? Like, just to be doing something?
There are really dark days, to be honest, when we look at projections for certain parts of the world, when we read the latest scientific article on sea level rise or impacts on food productions globally. So we'd better be in the thick of things, helping move the ball forward and helping inform. The more data, the more information, the more likely we'll make the right decisions, the more likely people will pay attention. You can make the business case that this will be money well spent because look at the risks and at the costs. So there is a hopeful component, but we do work on a pretty dark topic.
Yeah. Emily Mazzacarati is founder and CEO of the climate data firm 427. Thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Over on my show, Marketplace Tech, we've been doing a whole series on how technology can help us adapt to climate change. It's called How We Survive. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech podcast to hear all those stories. Now to a statistic that is pretty grim. In 2017, more than 350 people were intentionally shot dead at work. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's more than one person for every work day of that year. It is horrible, and we've got to look at it. Gun violence in the workplace is the focus of a new series at Marketplace.org. Reporter Jana Kasperkovic examines what the stats mean for employers and employees, from training and preparation to active shooter insurance to possible prevention techniques. You can find that whole series right now at Marketplace.org. Casinos are huge business in America. Earlier this week, Eldorado Resorts bought Caesars in a $17 billion deal. That behemoth is based in Nevada. But the second biggest state in non-tribal casino revenue is actually Pennsylvania. That's according to the American Gaming Association. Now, Pennsylvania's authorized a number of new casinos, including one on the edge of Amish and Mennonite country. As Miles Bryan reports, that is a culture clash that is not going well.
Take the Pennsylvania Turnpike west out of Philly for about 50 miles, and you'll hit Morgantown, PA, population 826. Edward Kurtz lives just off the highway on a piece of land that used to be part of the family farm started by his Mennonite grandfather. Just across the highway, on land that also used to be part of the farm, is the future site of Hollywood Casino Morgantown.
So I have some sentimental reasons that I don't like a casino right there.
Hollywood Morgantown received a state license in June. It's set to be the first of five new mini casinos in Pennsylvania. It's being built by Penn National Gaming, which owns 41 casinos and racetracks nationwide. The Morgantown Casino is expected to have 750 slot machines and 30 table games, much smaller than a full-size casino in the state that can have thousands of slot machines and hundreds of games. But some residents, like Kurtz, say a casino of any size is a bad fit for this area, a conservative rural part of the state where it's common to see families traveling via horse and buggy. I met 86-year-old Paul Stoltzfus, who's Amish, on his farm at the edge of town. It's been in his family for generations.
My dad had it. My granddad had it.
What do you grow?
Corn, wheat, and alfalfa.
Stoltzfus says a casino would disrupt what he calls his community's simple way of life.
Well, we like to make an honest living, and we don't like that in the backyard.
At a packed public input meeting, before plans for the casino were approved, resident after resident testified against it. They cited things like gambling addiction, fear of a rise in crime, and concern that it would change the area's traditional culture for the worse. But the plan has had the support of business and labor leaders, as well as local politicians. Alan Steyer, the chairman of the Board of Supervisors for the township that encompasses Morgantown, likes the numbers he's seen from the casino's builders.
They estimate that they're going to be contributing $1.6 million a year to the local tax base. Currently, our entire budget is $2.6 million a year.
Steyer says that, in addition to new tax revenue, the casino should bring in more traffic. That could lead to new restaurants and bars. And the casino's builders expect to create about 250 jobs that should pay an average of $40,000 to $45,000 a year with benefits. Jeff Morris is a spokesman for Penn National Gaming. He says the casino will be open 24/7, so
folks have the opportunity to, you know, to work around their schedule and, you know, frankly, the opportunity to grow.
Clyde Barrow is a professor at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. He's been studying casinos, particularly in the Northeast, since the early 90s. He says the promises and perils of the Morgantown Casino may be overblown.
Will it create jobs? Yes. Will you get the spinoff benefits of restaurants and motels and hotels? Probably not.
Barrow says smaller casinos like Hollywood Morgantown don't tend to pull people into neighborhood restaurants and bars. Gamblers go to the casino, game, and drive home. But Barrow says that means the casino is also not likely to have a big effect on the area's way of life.
My suspicion is, based on my experience, is if this casino is built, given its size, once it's up and running, most people won't even notice that it's there.
For Ed Kurtz, who lives just across the highway from the casino site, new jobs and more tax revenue don't mean much.
To them, it's an economic thing. To me, as a Christian, that's a poor excuse.
Penn National Gaming hopes to have Hollywood Casino Morgantown open by the end of next year. In Morgantown, Pennsylvania, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out from the Marketplace desk of let's lighten things up for a minute. You know how everyone is talking about plant-based meat replacements like Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat? Well, Adweek has a little write-up today about Arby's. You know.
Arby's, we have the meat.
No surprise, they are doubling down on the meat. Arby's put out a recipe today for a merit, a meat carrot. They call it a vegetable. And look, as we're discovering that plant-based proteins contain a lot of material other than plants, it is worth noting that a merit is made out of two things: turkey, dried carrot juice, and that's it.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, it's Kai. We've got a new podcast out I think you're going to want to subscribe to. It's called This Is Uncomfortable. It's a weekly show about life and how money messes with it. It's hosted by Rima Kreis. She tells funny and honest stories about how money affects relationships and shapes identities and often defines what it means to be an adult. Please subscribe to our new show. It's called This Is Uncomfortable, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 11 points today, basically flat. NASDAQ up 25 points, and the S&P 500 declined 3 points or 0.1%. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Jake Gorski, Drew Josted, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I am Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl will be back tomorrow. This is APM.